This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Talking Heads' Stop Making Sense has been called the greatest concert film of all time. Directed by Jonathan Demme, the iconic 1984 film takes the audience on stage with the band and captures them at the height of their power.
And now, in time for its upcoming 40th anniversary, a fully restored version of Stop Making Sense is back in theaters. It features propulsive performances with the band's early hits like Psycho Killer and Take Me to the River, along with deeper, weirder, and funkier cuts as well. I'm Aisha Harris.
And I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Stop Making Sense on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at betterhelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Joining us today is one of the co-hosts of NPR Music's Alt Latino, Felix Contreras. Welcome back, Felix.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me, man, for such a fun subject.
Yeah.
I know. It's so great to have you, especially for this. The film Stop Making Sense is a time capsule capturing the band Talking Heads as they toured their fifth studio album, Speaking in Tongues. This performance was filmed over several nights at the Pantages Theater in Los Angeles in December 1983. Unlike a lot of concert films, director Jonathan Demme doesn't include many shots of the audience. Instead, he brings us on stage and makes us a part of the performance. Stop Making Sense also boasts a unique structure for a concert film, a definite narrative arc. It begins with lead singer David Byrne walking out on stage alone with only a boombox to back him for Psycho Killer.
Psycho Killer, qu'est-ce que c'est?
As the night progresses, he's gradually joined by his bandmates, drummer Chris France, bassist Tina Weymouth, and Jerry Harrison on keyboards and guitar. They're also joined on stage by supporting musicians Bernie Worrell, Alex Weir, and Steve Scales, plus backup singers Edna Holt and Lynn Mabry, who are worth the price of admission alone. There are also risers, projection screens, and memorably, a floor lamp that becomes Byrne's dance partner. There are costume changes and lighting changes which build to an exultant and ecstatic finish, with Byrne's gawky, geeky onstage persona at the center of it all. A24 has produced a brand new 4K restoration of the film in time for its 40th anniversary. It's in IMAX theaters now and will be expanded to regular theaters this Friday. Felix, let me start with you. What's your experience with this band, this film, and what'd you think of the new version?
I forgot how good it is. Okay? Yeah. I mean, I saw the film when it first came out, and I had it on VHS. Okay? I'm of that age. I had it on VHS for a long time and would watch it every now and then on a small screen at home. But I really was super impressed with the story arc from the just a stripped-down version, which also is like a diagram of the band's music, too. Like, it starts with the quirky guitar thing, the lyrics, and then it just, everybody just started adding on. And from there, it just blew my mind. The one thing that really just killed me as soon as the whole band hit was how deep those grooves were, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They did a great job. I had forgotten just how good that band was live in this particular version of it.
Yeah. Now, Aisha, you hadn't seen this film before, but you knew the band, right?
So I think I knew that they existed and then they were in the ether. I think my earliest memories of them was probably first Indirect. It was the Tom Tom Club sample, The Genius of Love, and Mariah Carey's Fantasy. And then, of course, there's Kermit the Frog doing Once in a Lifetime on Muppets Tonight.
Once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
Coming to this movie was such an experience for the first time. I wanted to wait to see it in IMAX. This was the perfect opportunity. You know, greatest concert film of all time, they said.
A lot of hype.
Close to perfection, they said. Mm-hmm. Was that hyperbole? No, actually. Having experienced this now, I gotta say, this is an amazing movie. I loved it, and I'm really glad I got to see it for the first time and experience it almost as if I was in the room with them on IMAX.
Yeah, I think Felix and I envy you there. Look, I love this movie deeply. This movie sings to my soul. I saw it in 1984 at the TLA Theater on South Street in Philly. And I had discovered Talking Heads a couple of years earlier because, you know, in suburban Philly, you listen to classic rock or you were somehow suspect, probably gay. And, you know, they were right in my case, but that's no reason to go with them. Look, the Talking Heads gave me cover because rock stations played them back in the day. And yet they were still weird and experimental and nerdy. And they still spoke to my incredibly pretentious no one understands me kind of self back then. Mm. And I was thinking about this weekend. I think this is probably the one film I've seen more often than any other. So it's not just a film I like. It is a pillar of my identity. It is the North Star by which I navigated my adolescence and adulthood. But I got to be honest, I was not looking forward to this.
Why?
And here's why. Because I know this thing in my blood. And I came to it thinking, look, I don't think this film has much more it can surrender to me. What nuance could it possibly retain? Mm. And then the lights go down, right? And he walks out with that boombox. And,
hi, I've got a tape I'd like to play.
And immediately, I realized something that I hadn't even allowed myself to consider, which is how great it sounds. I have never heard it like this before. In hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of viewings, the sound is so rich and so deep and so funky.
Dancing the face up to the facts. Dancing nervous, can't relax.
I felt it. I felt it. Did you guys feel it?
Oh my God. I felt it. And there were people by like the fourth song, you know, found a job. I noticed that the audience, like the ones, I was all the way in the very back row, everyone in the front rows, it was just like a dance party for most of the movie. They were all in the aisles. There were some people who got up from the middle and like went down and danced with them.
Wow.
It was great. It was like being at a wedding. you know, it was like everyone was just kind of jamming and grooving in that sort of herky jerky cute way, like just wild abandon. And it was very infectious. I loved it.
Felix, what was your experience?
My own experience was with the Talking Heads was that I knew they were out there, but I wasn't listening to them. Mm-hmm. I was more into jazz, Latin music. Uh-huh. But then this album came out and Robert Hilburn from the LA Times wrote about it in a glowing way, the Remain in Light album.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I went out and when I bought the album and honestly it changed my life. Changed the way I listened to music, and I understood how genres can expand and converge. The way he brought all of these other musicians, the funk musicians, Bernie Worrell, all of these guys, into an already existing pretty killer rhythm section with Tina and Chris. It was amazing to hear that record. I still listen to it in a sense of wonder and awe because it's just so powerful what they did. Mm-hmm. And then just having the film because I'm a geek like you guys. I have a ton of concert films on VHS, DVD, you know, et cetera, right? But coming back to today or this weekend, seeing it again, like you said, the sound was amazing.
Yeah.
And seeing it on IMAX, just so big. It really was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, that brings me to the Jonathan Demme of it all, which I want to talk about for a bit, because the question that stuck with me in this latest viewing was, look, what is the Jonathan Demme factor here? Because this is a great band live. They've got choreography. They've got lighting. They've got rear projections. You know, this story we're talking about, it's like this story of a lonely, nerdy, out-of-touch guy who's literally buttoned up in every sense of the term. And then gradually he loosens up, lets other people into his life, and gives in to the power of music. So where is Jonathan Demme in all of this? Because if you were ungenerous, you could say you could point a camera at this band at the height of their power at this time in this concert, and you'd come away with something interesting. But he made something that I think we all agree is kind of indelible. And Jonathan Demme, as a filmmaker, was not a stylist. He was not – I don't think he'd consider himself an auteur. But he wasn't like you're just journeyman, you know, like Cypher. What he did, he served the narrative. Very rarely in his films did he do something really showy. Like his go-to move in Silence of the Lambs was to have a character stare down the barrel of the camera. You know, that was like the showiest thing he ever did. So do you guys have a sense of what he brought to this mix of how he served the narrative?
So I think part of it, as you mentioned earlier, Glenn, is the fact that there's less focus on the audience than there is on just what's happening on stage. Because oftentimes you do have the cuts to the audience to get the reactions. And we don't really get that except for the very end, like the last couple minutes of it. Mm-hmm. And I think also there's just a lot of really great editing going on here. Lisa Day is the editor. And I think when they choose to focus on David Byrne and when they choose to focus on all the other people on stage and when they bring them all together, like I think that's really, really effective. And just being able to see, especially as everyone's coming on stage, a sneak peek of behind the scenes. Like we see the crew rolling the set onto stage, the drum set. Mm-hmm. Those things, those little details give the DIY effect, even though obviously this is a very intricate piece of performance art, but it does still have this sort of lo-fi quality to it, especially in the beginning. And I think that is the way that this movie is really supporting the vision that the Talking Heads had for this, which is like, keep it kind of lo-fi, not too showy, not too obvious, and just really immerse yourself in this world.
One of the tools that he used to do that was to focus so much on David Byrne because having never seen him live, I don't have that experience. But when you're watching film, you know, you can't take your eyes off the guy, right?
Yeah.
For a lot of different reasons, the way he moves, his dance stuff, those little things that he choreographed.
Yep.
Plus, it almost looks like he doesn't blink the way he stares, like he's singing.
Black eyes, lifeless eyes.
You know what I mean?
Doll's eyes. Yep.
He is the center of attention, obviously.
Yeah.
And there's enough of the periphery stuff going on that you see how the band is working and how they're working with him, how they're working with David Byrne at the front. You know, there's just, I don't know what the technique or style is, but, when I compare it to other concert films as well, you know, and how the different directors pull those off and try to figure out what the difference is, you know, I think that watching him work with the band, it's like you're on the stage and you're with the band and you're looking for like a smile or a cue or something from another musician. From the musician standpoint, that's what it felt like. Felt like being on a stage with them.
Hmm.
That's, I think, the magic of the film.
Yeah, I pulled a clip from Once in a Lifetime because I think that illustrates what Jonathan Demme is bringing to the mix here. So we spend the entire song in a medium shot of Byrne, and the camera is fixed. Now, that is unusual because for most of this film, we are roaming the stage.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the editor, Lisa Day, is cutting on the downbeat. But now we get this, and you can see why, because, you know, Byrne is doing his nerdy white guy shtick as if the music is kind of like rocking his body, and it's very entertaining. But then as the song is ending, and we get to Time Isn't Holding Us, Time Isn't After Us. Keyboards kind of slide in over top of everything. And now we cut to a shot of Byrne with Lynn Mabry and Edna Holt behind him, and the light's gone suddenly moody, and they have arched, they are leaning backwards, and they have their backs arched, and they are slowly in unison rising like Frankenstein from the slab.
Yes.
And that's a reveal. We all realize, oh, there's been all this other stuff going on this whole time. We've been looking at David Byrne. Right. And the thing about David Byrne is he's the center of attention, but it's not like he lets us in, right? As you say, there is no real raw emotion with him. It's like there's intellect and then there's dancing. It's like there's no emotion in between, or what there is, I guess there is joy, right? There's ecstatic joy, but like it's very mediated, it's processed, it's very intellectual.
I don't know if I kind of got a different sense from that. Like I, in my own notes, I kind of wrote, I already mentioned this sort of wedding vibe I was getting from just the audience I was with, but like
sure,
he also
yes.
reminds me of that guy at every wedding who may or may not have had like a few too many drinks and is just in yep. the zone, really feeling the music. And he looks like the happiest guy in the world. And I think to me, that sense of sort of just like not having a care in the world maybe is what you're seeing as like not emotion. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. You have the moment with the lamp, of course, and he's tossing it back and forth. And it reminded me a little bit of the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. And like mm-hmm. the way that Dorothy is like her, she's just watching him and her head keeps moving back and forth. And he's just bouncing around from side to side. She's like, what's going to happen? And then you have Edna Holt and Lynn Mabry. They have this very brief moment where you see as he's moving side to side, they both look at him like, oh, look, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? And they're like slightly swaying with him. And I just, that to me is just that little playfulness and that sort of just like, it seems off the cuff and maybe they've done it in other times before, but like, I don't know. I get from him just a sense of joy and just, I don't have a care in a world, even if it is kind of sort of buttoned up still, you know?
That's your shtick. What do you think, Felix? Break the tie.
what is the tie? I think that, I don't know if that was a shtick or if that was his real persona, if he was really that kind of quirky, because mm-hmm. he's a character, man. I mean, and if it is a character, he never breaks character. A few times he's smiling and he's laughing, but usually when you're with the band, you know, you turn around and something, there's some kind of interaction, but he's like, okay, I've got this thing. I'm looking out at the audience and I'm doing my little dances and I'm like not blinking and I'm singing these songs where I will confess, I still don't know what the F they're about, okay? And it's just, you know what I mean? It's
like, that's the thing.
They're catchy and, they, you know, you sing along, you do all this, you know. In that moment when he's actually performing them and he's zeroing in on this persona, it's just part of the whole thing. I just appreciated it for its wholeness.
Yeah.
Because there's this loose, funky thing all around him with the percussion and keyboard and that killer rhythm guitar. And then there's David Byrne right in the middle of it, just being quirky and rigid and everything and dancing in his own funky way. I just appreciated the whole. So I won't break the tie. I'm just saying.
Okay. Here's what I'll say. I think what happens is he lets us see this funkiness that you're talking about, Felix, get to him. Like he's like a cat who suddenly gets the zoomies and he turns Life During Wartime into a track and field meet by just jogging and jogging and jogging around the stage and jogging in place. And like this is the only thing that's changed between me seeing it then and seeing it as a 55-year-old man. It's like, oh boy, how could he sing a lyric? How could he sing a word after doing all that?
Yeah. I mean, the stamina of that, it's so fascinating to me. And look, I think that David Byrne might be one of the greatest rock dancer frontmen ever. I don't know.
Wow.
I'm putting it out there. He's just so immersive and fascinating to watch. And I love this movie, man. I'm excited that I saw it, and I'm going down a rabbit hole of Talking Heads music.
This is great. Just pull up a chair by me and Felix.
The other thing I do very quickly is that I put it in the context of what was going on back then. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea at that time of some of the white musicians reaching out across the aisle to bring in other influences, like he did with Remain in Light, like Bowie did in 83 with Nile Rodgers and Let's Dance. Sting with Dream of the Blue Turtles and what was 85 with all the jazz musicians. There was this magic moment that had me buying stuff from artists that I never would have bought before because they were all of a sudden they were speaking my language, right? They're like, oh, well, maybe there is something. Let me hear what this Talking Heads guy is about because I didn't pay attention to him before. I knew what the Police was, you know, it sounded like a reggae ripoff. I wasn't really a big fan. But whenever they started doing all this other stuff and adding these musicians, amazing. Mm-hmm. So Talking Heads, Remain in Light, Speaking in Tongues, and Stop Making Sense are of a whole to me. It's part of an era. Yeah. So I appreciate it on that level as well.
it's kind of the ideal version of like that kind of cultural exchange right. between white right. and non-white musicians, and how they feel as mm-hmm. if there's a respect, a mutual respect and understanding. And I think that's what's happening here. And you can absolutely see that in this film.
That's a great thing to end on, I think. So we love this movie. We love, despite my old man reservations, we love seeing it at an IMAX theater. You'll love seeing it at a regular theater. You'll just love this movie, I think. So we want to know what you think about Stop Making Sense. You're going to love it. If you don't, just don't tell us. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. Felix Contreras, Aisha Harris, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, man, it's always a
Thank
blast.
Thank you. Same as it ever was.
Great mixes. Same as it ever was. This is not my beautiful podcast. We want to take a moment to thank our Pop Culture Happy Hour Plus subscribers. We appreciate you so much for showing your support of NPR. If you haven't signed up yet, you want to show your support and to listen to the show without a single solitary sponsor break, head over to plus.npr.org/happyhour or visit the link in our show notes. This episode was produced by Thomas Liu and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Leesa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.